So we're really lucky today because we get an hour with Nicholas Kristof. As you all know, Nick has been a columnist at the New York Times for several years now. We're all pretty much addicted to his regular column. He's been in that role since 2001, I believe. And both he and his wife were Pulitzer Prize winners. You know that his wife is named Cheryl Wudong, and they won a prize for their coverage of the Tiananmen Square incident in China. And then Nick later in 2003 won a prize for his coverage of the genocide in Darfur. They're authors of three best-selling books together, co-authors. One is China Wakes, A Struggle for the Soul of a Rising Power. The second is Thunder from the East, Portrait of a Rising Asia in 2000. And then the third is Half the Sky. I know everybody in this room has read Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. And in fact, the last time Nick came and visited us, it was when that book had first come out. And I'm going to open this current book that he's just written focuses in part on the nature of the of basically intergenerational nature of poverty, and then on the role that philanthropy can play. So I'm going to start out by asking Nick about philanthropy and its role, because if you look at the kind of the headlines of the New York Times, you can't get away from the fact that there are some key global problems that threaten us, but threaten others. The governments can't solve all alone. So let's just sort of start terrorism, climate change, even endemic poverty and infectious diseases. So I wanted to start out with ISIL and Boko Haram, the terrorist groups we worry about right now, and ask you, is there a role for philanthropy in all that, in addressing a danger like that?
I think there is. I think that it is partly about advocacy, actually. I mean, we tend to think of philanthropy in terms of delivery of services, and certainly to the extent one can educate girls in Afghanistan or northern Nigeria, that's important. But I wouldn't neglect advocacy. And I guess the larger point I would make is that we as a country, intuitively, since 9/11, we have tried to combat terrorism, civil conflict, with military toolbox. And the military toolbox has real uses. Just recently in the airstrikes in Iraq against Islamic State, they genuinely helped avert massacres against the Yazidis. But the military toolbox is also incredibly expensive and over the long run not particularly effective. And the education toolbox, the women's empowerment toolbox, the economic development toolboxes, those also have a real role in this, and we tend to underutilize them. People sometimes think that those are kind of soft and fringy, and I just look at the difference between Bangladesh and Pakistan, both originally part of the same country, of course. The one thing Bangladesh did was educate its girls, and there are now more girls than boys in high school in Bangladesh. I think that's one reason why Bangladesh is not harboring jihadis. Oman and Yemen are right next door to each other. Oman used to be poorer than Yemen. It then educated girls, educated everybody. And again, that's one reason I think why it's nice and boring and stable and not in the news, which is what our aim is. And so I think to the extent there's kind of a market failure in our approaches, I think that advocacy to some extent can help push the buttons both for donor countries like the U.S., but also for the countries on the ground to rectify the way they have their policies. I mean, Pakistan, I lost count of how many tens of billions we've supplied to Pakistan in military assistance since 9/11, and obviously in the short run, education isn't going to accomplish much. In this period, since 9/11, if there had been a major push on girls' education, that actually would have really made a difference. And so I tend to think of advocacy to try to end up with better policies as something that, is an important role that philanthropy can make.
And of course, there's an organization that focuses on education of girls in Pakistan called Development in Literacy, DIL.
Yeah.
And I think you've written about DIL.
I have, indeed. Yeah. Yeah, and DIL was started by some Pakistani Americans who wanted to give back, and so they started schools around Pakistan, and Cheryl and I have contributed to them. I mean, it's such a great organization doing great work, and it is you know, as a reporter, I've got to say, it's so frustrating to me to travel around Pakistan or West Africa, and you see medieval-minded misogynists investing in their kind of education, in Wahhabi madrasas, and we don't compete. I mean, they recognize the transformative power of education, and it sort of seems to me as if we don't. And likewise, the Taliban, Boko Haram, they understand the threat that comes to them from the power of education. That's why they shoot Malala. That's why they kidnap Nigerian schoolgirls. And it just seems odd to me that we don't have the same, we don't have as sophisticated an understanding of the power of education, for good or ill, that they do. We are really not competing.
And let's talk about them for a minute, right? Not only, not just the victims of their terror, but also their motivations. What is it that's missing in the life of these restless young men who are attracted to this kind of belonging in something greater, and does philanthropy have a role there? Thinking through how to fill that gap, whatever it is.
I mean, the irony is that in A Path to Peers, we're sort of talking about how people can find purpose and fulfillment in their lives here through various charitable engagements, through some kind of connecting to a cause larger than themselves. And I think that one reason why young, disillusioned folks from Minnesota or elsewhere, join ISIS is partly because they too feel unfulfilled and are looking for some connection to a cause larger than themselves in this incredibly misguided way. They end up joining something that feels to them spiritual, feels to them as if it's greater than themselves, and that's tragic and delusional. But I think that is part of what it is coming out of, and how we address that, I don't know. To some extent, I think it represents educational failure in kids who are marginalized in the labor force, partly because of that educational failure. In England, there have been some interesting experiments with empowering some members of the Islamist community, sort of nonviolent members of the Islamist community, to have a greater voice and criticize those who are on the more radical fringe. My sense is that that has a lot more impact than than New York Times columnists denouncing jihadis. How one reaches these people, changes their ideas, I think that's a really hard problem.
Yeah. And so is there a bit of a legitimizing role that we sometimes inadvertently play? I mean, if what they do leads the President of the United States to address the nation and address the United Nations, or puts them on the front page of the greatest newspapers in the world, are we inadvertently having a legitimizing effect?
I think at the margins we do in that respect. I think we unfortunately end up, I mean, the place where we end up recruiting for them and legitimizing them even more than that, I think, is in airstrikes that miss, which is obviously to some extent inevitable. And that's why it is so important to have Sunni partners, because if it is America dropping the bombs, and then invariably there are going to be some kids who are injured. ISIS is very good with social media. They're going to have video clips of that. And this will feed into the narrative of, America attacking Sunnis, trying to kill Sunni children. And I think it's a hard problem, but I think the way we deal with that is make sure that we have Sunni partners in the effort and be much more active on social media. And we've done a better job of that over the last few years, but I think we're still being outclassed by ISIS at the moment in social media.
So let me take you to another global problem, and that is the initial outbreak and now the contagion of Ebola. There are a lot of, philanthropy has pursued a lot of disease-specific campaigns, eradicate guinea worm, eradicate polio, address HIV, malaria. But what about the strengthening of health systems? I realize that sounds not very romantic,
yeah,
but this might have been avoidable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Liberia, as you know, only had 50 doctors at the time of the outbreak. You know, there too, I think that one important role that philanthropy can play is as kind of a watchdog, an advocacy role. You know, Ebola broke out, this is the end of 2013. This is something that for pennies could have been resolved early on, and a huge savings in human life as well. And the countries themselves blew it. The international community blew it. And so we will end up spending far more money and vast cost of lives and a global scare because of that. And obviously there are, I mean, indeed much of the response has been through NGOs and that, you know, if safety nets fail, then that can make a difference. But I think that to some extent, advocating and raising these issues and pushing for early responses, both from international or from donor countries, from the U.S., as well as from the nations themselves, is one way of generating more of a response. And you know, I sort of appeal to you on that basis. Traditionally, that was kind of the role of us in the news media, that, you know, we would be reporting on global crises, and that would project them onto the agenda, and then that would lead to various steps of a response. Well, we in the news media have kind of lost our business model, and especially television is not going to be reporting very much from West Africa, because one thing that executive producers have figured out is they can send a camera crew to West Africa, and it'll be expensive, and there'll be a certain amount of risk. And when they finally air the program, viewers will switch the channel to somebody else where they have a Democrat and a Republican yelling at each other in a studio, which is incredibly cheap and kind of more entertaining. One of the things that I found most depressing was that the Gates Foundation had essentially bribed ABC News they called it a grant, but it bribed ABC News to cover global health and nutrition. And this was controversial within the development community because, you know, why should they be using their money not to deliver services for people who desperately need it, but rather for these overpaid television executives to do what they should be doing anyway? But over the course of that year, ABC actually did some really good reports about maternal mortality, about vitamin A deficiency, and it did elevate these issues on the agenda. So after a year, the Gates Foundation was ready to renew the bribe. And this time, ABC News said, no, we don't want to take your money, because their metrics are such that they could tell that when they air important global stories, that's when people switch the channel or go to the bathroom. And, you know, I think for those of us who care about these kinds of issues, that is really discouraging. And it suggests there is going to be a vacuum in this kind of reporting. And if stories don't get on the agenda, they're not going to get addressed. So how do we fill that vacuum? I think that human rights organizations are to some degree filling the vacuum left by international news media. I think think tanks can do it a little bit. Various nonprofits and watchdogs can do it. And I think the public can also hold our feet to the fire and, you know, call on journalists to indeed cover the news occasionally. So, you know, if that's, I guess that's kind of one of the things I really am concerned by, the collapse of the business model means that there's going to be less coverage of a lot of really important issues, and when those issues aren't covered, that they just don't get addressed.
It's interesting because in many ways you use your column to make up for the deficit of reporting. You shine a spotlight on a given issue, you provide the facts, and yes, it's wrapped into a point of view, sometimes a call, but you are moving the facts forward to a public audience.
Yeah, but I must say that even I see this, that if I, you know, if I write about a hot button issue, then it gets much more traction. You know, everybody says, oh, great column today about whatever. And, you know, or I can go halfway around the world, Central African Republic, spend a ton of the New York Times' money, take a certain amount of risk, and then it just disappears without a ripple. And so you can, I mean, I deeply believe in that kind of reporting, and I will continue to do it, but you can't do that all the time, and I understand why executive producers aren't doing it.
Yeah. I'm going to take you to another, staying with Ebola for a minute. We did have a positive experience, and that was Nigeria. When it had its outbreak, it was able to contain it. Now, there, we had already in place was a collaborative effort to combat polio. So you already had CDC in there, had trained 100 physicians. The Gates Foundation had created a clinic, you know, for rapid action. WHO was in there. They were working with the local ministry. To what extent can philanthropy, in its effort to achieve one goal, actually strengthen government capacity, state capacity in a positive sense, as kind of a byproduct? And should that be something conscious?
I think it should be something conscious, and indeed, I think everybody recognizes intellectually that in supporting health programs globally, we should be doing more to build local capacity. The problem is, of course, that it's incredibly unsexy. And in general, any philanthropic program, anything you can put your name on gets overinvested in, and anything you can't put your name on gets underinvested in. And so, I mean, universities are the masters of this. They figure out how to sell the same thing about 18 different times. It's harder to do that with some really important things. It's harder to do that with building capacity. It's harder to do that with micronutrients. It's harder to do that with some basic nutrition programs. And some of the areas where you get the most bang for the buck are also those that are hardest to put your name on and thereby to give this sense of, you know, the warm glow that one gets from writing those checks. And so, you know, there are some folks who don't care so much about the warm glow and they're driven by metrics. But I think that those are the minority, and I think we have to figure out a better way of putting names, so to speak, on some really important interventions that that make a huge difference. Deworming is, you know, incredibly cost-effective intervention, but how do you put somebody's name on a deworming effort? And it's also not the kind of thing that people are going to, you know, boast about at a cocktail party. Oh, yeah, I dewormed, you know. It becomes a little bit awkward.
So we have a tendency to focus on the big guys like Gates, that actually is completely metrics-driven, right? But there are also small donations that can be made that you point out in your book, the club feet effort, the trachoma effort. Say something about that and the opportunity for just folks, like everyone in this room, me, who can only give smaller donations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, trachoma. People always ask how it is that I manage to cover genocide, global poverty, sex trafficking, and basically be kind of upbeat and reasonably cheerful. And, you know, the truth is partly that side by side with the worst of humanity, you see the very best. So you see warlords doing terrible things, and you see amazing people combating them that just reaffirm your faith in the capacity of humans to do the right thing. The other is that I genuinely see progress. When I first backpacked through Africa in 1982 as a law student, the single thing that I think upset me the most was the cases of blindness. There's so many middle-aged people in every city who were begging because they were blind and had to take a kid out of school to lead them around. And it was, you know, an economic catastrophe for them. It was so demeaning, such a cost of human dignity. And you know, many of those cases were trachoma, which is just about the most painful way to go blind. We, in A Path Appears, we quote one woman who said it was like the pain of childbirth day in, day out, year in, year out. And because she was unable to farm, she lost several of her children, because they starved to death because she couldn't support them. And then she got a $40 surgery through Helen Keller International, $40. And it, you know, the bandages come off and somebody asks her, you know, do you want some help? And she He says, get out of my way. I can see now. I can go home by myself. And it's, you know, that is just inspiring. That's uplifting. That's not depressing. And when you see what one can accomplish periodically for tiny amounts of money, like you mentioned Clubfoot, you know, only when we were writing A Path Appears did it turn out that my mom had actually been born with Clubfoot. But, you know, in the U.S., about 1 in 1,000 people are born with Clubfoot, but nobody knows it because it's rectified as a small child. In much of the rest of the world, if you were that 1 in 1,000, you end up a beggar. You won't go to school. You won't be able to contribute. And this is something that can be rectified early on really, really cheaply. So we followed the donation of a woman in Santa Monica to a hospital in Niger that ended up transforming this little girl's life. So it can be done.
So Niger brings me to a different topic, and that is that the role of evidence. And you quote Esther Duflo of the poverty lab at MIT as having found that there was real evidence that a BRAC program worked. If you could tell us something about that program and why it worked.
Yeah, this was fascinating. And so Esther Duflo is this wonky, numbers-driven, very data-driven economist at MIT. And she was trying to measure very, very carefully a program that had originated with BRAC that gives livestock, mostly cows, to the very, very poorest families. And when she did this study, the numbers didn't add up. The impact was too good. And it, because not only had the income from livestock increased for these families, which made sense, but they were also getting much more money from their private agricultural plots, which made no sense, had nothing to do with a cow. And they were earning more money from their sideline jobs, which again, had nothing to do with a cow. And so she went back and studied this, and it suggested to her, and I think she's absolutely right, that one of the poverty traps that exists, I think, spinning this off a little further from where she takes it, but that one of the poverty traps, both at home and abroad, is a kind of despair and hopelessness that in turn leads to self-destructive behaviors, which are a hard part of poverty to talk about, but are very, very real. And those self-destructive behaviors in turn make that hopelessness self-fulfilling and often self-replicating for the next generation. And there is some indication that depression, clinical depression, is very, very widespread among the very poor, and in turn, again, is part of this poverty trap. It impedes people's ability to work, to earn money, to care for their kids. And that, therefore, one of the ways to break this cycle of poverty is to provide this wonderfully amorphous thing called hope. And that maybe one of the reasons why various interventions work is not because of the nature of that intervention itself, but because suddenly that family has the notion that, well, now actually we can have a different outcome. And that was what happened with this BRAC project with the cows, that once they got this cow, then all of a sudden they thought that maybe they can have a very different future. They worked many more hours in their private agricultural plot. They worked more hours on sideline jobs. In some cases, there seems to be less spending on temptation goods, which is exactly the reverse of what you think. And you know, temptation goods are a huge problem all over. And globally, as an order of magnitude, families earning less than $2 a day probably spend about 10 times as much on a combination of alcohol, cigarettes, prostitution, and sugary drinks, and very extravagant festivals, 10 times as much on that as they do on educating their kids, which has a wonderful economic return. And so, you know, how do you switch that kind of spending pattern? I think partly it's by giving people a sense that different outcomes are possible. I've really kind of become persuaded by And once you begin to sort of, once you're aware of this line of research, then there's a lot of other things that tend to buttress it. I think it's true probably both domestically and abroad.
There's also a role for trust. And so I want to get a sense of this from you. There's the World Bank found at a certain point that making direct cash transfers to the poor actually works. There's now an organization called Give Directly that allows you to do that, any individual in this room, to make a cash transfer to the very poor. What did they learn? What did they know? That it's so counterintuitive to us. We think we have to monitor. We think we need evidence and proof.
So there was a good randomized controlled trial in Kenya of Give Directly, and it found that there did not seem to be more spending on temptation goods. There it's a one-time gift, not renewable. So families know they have a, you know, they're not getting it more. And it did not lead to more spending on temptation goods. It did seem to increase incomes, and it seemed to work surprisingly well. I mean, there's still going to be a debate about whether you get more bang for the buck out of that than out of whatever, you know, subsidizing school uniforms or deworming kids or vaccinating kids, whatever it may be, but it worked remarkably well.
So let's take this conversation domestically for a moment, because you made reference to early childhood and about the fact that the kids of the poor tend to be poor themselves. Starting with sort of what we've learned about brain science, what we've learned about the way the brain develops in the first 2 years of life, and the ways in which we can, you know, give a kid a good start. Or give them a start that, you know, almost inevitably leads to failure in school, failure in relationships, et cetera.
You know, there was a view, and it was, you know, it was perfectly plausible that kids who aren't being mollycoddled all the time end up more resilient. They end up doing more independent-minded or able to do more. And if they're not being, you know, just look fussed over all the time, and that in any case, kids are tremendously resilient. So, you know, even if you screw up at the beginning, you know, then they can recover. It turns out that both things are essentially wrong, and there's good evidence on both fronts that and rat studies and human studies both. Kids who have strong maternal attachment at age 3.5, that degree of maternal attachment is a better predictor of high school graduation than IQ is. Rats who get licked and fussed over by their moms do better in mazes as adults. And it's not inherited. If you take away the rat pups from the moms who are really the lickers and give them to the non-licking moms, then it's the rats that were actually licked, whatever their parentage, that end up more self-confident, doing better at mazes. And the causal pathway here seems to be that when one is under great stress, what pediatricians call toxic stress, that under toxic stress for an infant, maybe as a result of what diaper that doesn't change or people yelling or whatever it may be, then your brain produces cortisol, the stress hormone. And a little bit of cortisol now and then is a good thing. But if your brain, if you're under constant stress, constantly producing cortisol, then that actually affects the architecture of your brain. And you can see the impact in brain scans. And your hippocampus is different. Your prefrontal cortex is less developed, which is impulse control. You're essentially programmed for a very, very stressful world. Your fight or flight response is on edge. And these kids are not particularly resilient. We know that from when the Romanian regime collapsed in 1989. Some kids were randomly chosen to be taken out of orphanages where they had been neglected and put into good foster homes. It turned out that what mattered was crucially the age at which they were taken out of the orphanage. If you were taken out before the age of 2, you could recover to some degree. Taken out after the age of 2, you were kind of cooked. And you can see, again, brain scans of these much older kids. You can really distinguish which ones were taken out at age 2 and which ones were taken out afterward. And, you know, this also it relates to this hard thing to talk about, which is parenting gaps. And this is something that is awkward. It sounds like, you know, one's being very judgmental, but it's also real and has real income, real impacts on kids. A child of a professional's by age 4 has heard 30 million more words than a child on welfare. 30 million more. They begin to speak at the same time, but by age 4, that child of professionals has heard so much more, so many more words, that they're more verbal, they're better prepared for school, they have a richer vocabulary. And we now know that there are interventions that essentially coach parents to hug their child more, to do the equivalent of licking, cuddling, and to read to their child. You know, many homes don't have any children's books in those homes. And that those interventions, they don't work in every case. They work in many, many cases. They're pretty cheap. They have far-reaching effects. One intervention ends at age 2, but encourage these kind of early parenting things. It ends at age 2 for at-risk kids. At age 15, those kids are only half as likely to have been arrested. And yet, that program only reaches 2 to 3% of those kids who need it in this country. It's just another example of our, so often we as a country are, you know, we spend hugely picking the high-hanging fruit and don't pick the low-hanging fruit at all.
Is that the Nurse Family
Partnership?
That's
the Nurse Family Partnership.
So do you have a sense as to why things like that are underfunded? Do we need to wait for you to do a book before the word gets out?
Part of the problem, again, is it's kind of a boring program. You know, they send nurses out to these at-risk moms, beginning when they're pregnant, and they tell them, you know, don't drink, don't do drugs. After birth, you know, breastfeed your child, talk to your child a lot. But it is a little bit boring. And I think that makes it, and also I think there is this intuitive sense that kids are resilient. You know, and this, we shouldn't really be fussing over kids at the beginning of life. Conversely, though, I sometimes think that there is actually that some of these interventions may be politically feasible, whereas others aren't. And I wonder if we on the left don't talk too much about inequality and not enough about opportunity. I think opportunity may be one of those words that is actually better for building bridges. In polling, opportunity, things to build opportunity do really, really well. One poll found 97% of Americans actually agree that there should be greater efforts by government to equalize opportunity at the beginning of life. 97% of Americans don't agree that the world is round. You know, so if there can be some agreement on that, that is, I think, you know, truly encouraging. And some of the red states have actually been leaders. Oklahoma, Utah, they've been leaders in things like Nurse Family Partnership because they see it saves money. You know, if you don't pay money up front, you're going to pay money at the back end with prisons, this kind of thing. Same with family planning. It's ridiculous that 30% of American kids get pregnant by age 19. You know, hello? I mean, we have plenty of evidence-based programs that show that providing long-acting reversible contraceptives like implants, like IUDs, to teenagers who want help, that has a dramatic effect on teen pregnancy rates. And when we don't provide that, then the result is disaster for the girl who typically ends up ending her education, and for that kid who is being raised by a stressed-out 16-year-old unmarried girl and, you know, isn't getting the support they need. We can do better on all these fronts.
Several of the question cards speak to the role of the private sector and ask where, on two levels, where the large multinational corporations can play and have played a role in addressing some of these sort of endemic problems. And the second is, what about small and growing enterprise as a key poverty alleviation tool? But I'm going to start with a sort of shared value, how a corporation, if you have examples of corporation making a positive difference.
Cheryl has really been the evangelizer for me. She really kind of taught me about the role of corporations here, and I think it's potentially huge. I mean, one of the problems with nonprofits is that they're this profusion of tiny, tiny organizations that don't scale very well, often don't play well together, there's no M&A. And in contrast, when a corporation fills as a part of its business model, when it engages in some of these issues, that has a potentially vast effect and sustainable because it is part of the business model. When one example we talk about in A Path Appears has to do with Bangladesh. There's a real problem with very poor families getting protein for kids and getting micronutrients. Well, I mean, so various nonprofits could have tried to develop fish ponds or some other kind of small-scale source of protein. They could hand out these little sachets of micronutrient powders. But what Grameen did was it partnered with Danone, the yogurt company, to build a yogurt factory in Bangladesh. And, you know, they understand how to make yogurt. So they went back through the cows. They built up a supply chain with farmers having cows that actually managed to produce milk and then produced yogurt with micronutrients in it and priced it, figured out how to price it competitively so that poor families can afford it. And that's done at a... And Danone doesn't want to lose money on the project, but they don't really care about making money either. They recognize that, you know, in this day and age, a company has to care about values for recruitment, for retention, for relations, of employees. If a company thinks that its long-term, purely financial interest, that its share price depends just on financial metrics, then it is just myopic. If it wants to recruit good millennials, keep them, it is going to have to worry about its image, about CSR, this kind of thing. And so Danone did this, I think, partly because it provided a sense of mission. They wanted to do the right thing. And it has helped Danone in that regard. And it has been hugely helpful for some really poor families in Bangladesh that now get yogurt. And, they're... kids get micronutrients. That's the kind of thing that's, I think, an example of what we should be looking at more ways for companies to have a social mission as well in ways that are sustainable and have a vast impact.
You have written extensively about the problem of human trafficking and the problem of forced labor. And I mean, what is it, 21 million people in the world right now are slaves?
Numbers of 27 people, nobody really knows, but that's 27 million is the number that usually goes around.
Yeah. There's a situation where the private sector has got a huge role to play. I mean, if Whole Foods in trying to purchase fish and shrimp from a supplier in Southeast Asia, they work to try to find out whether there might be slaves in that supply chain. And there's an example where, in fact, a nonprofit and a for-profit have worked well together.
Can partner together very effectively for the benefit of both. Likewise, sourcing, if companies... we'll try to have more products made by women, for example. That has a powerful effect on the supply chain. If companies will periodically lend out their staff for a kind of a 6-month sabbatical to a nonprofit, that is incredibly powerful because nonprofits, partly because they tend not to pay well, partly because they don't have great training programs, they are often starved of particular expertise. And so if they can be lent a marketing expert or a customer relations management expert or accounting, IT people, all these things can sometimes really improve the productivity in the nonprofit sector as well as just rejuvenate employees and give the company itself a certain kick.
This kind of takes me to one of the dangers in philanthropy, and that is that nonprofits that are noisy, that choose a strategy of naming and shaming, for example, rather than working with the company to quietly do an audit of their supply chain and helping helping them fix the problem. It's those naming and shaming and noisy NGOs that can get the grant more easily. There's huge pressure from those who give on those who seek grants to get a lot of publicity. How can we turn that around? How can
I mean, I think naming and shaming has its uses, as does, I mean, I think both, they kind of, they're both strategies that when they're done together, they both actually have a have an impact. But it's true that kind of, I mean, there's so many ways in which our efforts to help others are just kind of dysfunctional. I mean, not least that we have this bifurcation in our minds where between nonprofits, you know, good, noble, for-profits, you know, evil. And obviously what matters isn't the tax status of an entity, it's what kind of impact it has. And there are plenty of nonprofits that don't accomplish anything, and there are plenty of for-profits that some do a lot of harm and some that do a lot of good. And one should be able to have the sophistication to understand that. And likewise, we have this bifurcation where we're willing to take some money and we invest it in the market and we want the maximal profit, you know, possible return from it. We don't want to compromise on that return one bit. Meanwhile, we have this pool we call our, you know, our charitable sum, and we just toss it out and we don't want any return from that at all. And indeed, it would make a lot more sense to have some kind of hybrid and be willing to invest some money, and maybe we just want to keep the capital, or we want a diminished return, in the knowledge that it's going to actually have some social good. There should be some continuum rather than just this, you know, this bifurcation.
Now, we have 4 or 5 different questions about China and about the expansion of wealth there, of private wealth there, and the possibility for indigenous philanthropy there. Have you had a chance to interact with some of the folks that are thinking that way within China?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, both China and India are kind of, they do not really have philanthropic traditions, and and this is all very recent and new, but they are, in both cases, you are getting some individuals who kind of get it and are beginning to give back. I'd say it has tended not to be very sophisticated, and it's also partly connected to the fact that much of the money, much of the huge fortunes in China are somewhat ill-gotten. And also, if you have an ill-gotten fortune, then you want to hide a fair amount of it in other countries. I probably want to buy a bunch of condos in San Francisco, for example. But that is beginning to happen. You're beginning to see better philanthropy in both China and India. The one place that I think I wish there was more sophistication was of zakat, the Islamic charitable giving, because the sums are huge. Zakat is sort of the Islamic version of tithing, but it's a function, it's a reflection of wealth, not income. And so the sums can be huge, but it tends not to be done in kind of a formal way with careful metrics to, you know, organizations. If that money could go to girls' education in Pakistan, for example, that would just be a huge boon to Pakistan, to the country. And there's people who are beginning to talk about that kind of thing, but not enough.
We have an interesting recent example, and that's Aliko Dangote in Nigeria, the wealthiest man in Africa, who's Muslim, who has always given as part of his religious commitment. But he's now hired a woman out of the Ford Foundation. He is looking at how to be more strategic. In particular, he's looking at what difference can he make with regard to Boko Haram and its appeal.
Oh, good for him.
So this is, but it may be, you know, part of that story may be that the influence of Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and other individuals who are kind of iconic around the world have in fact established that this is a cool thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always think it kind of began with Ted Turner when he, you know, was invited to give his speech and didn't know what he was going to say, and at least his version of it is that he decided to give away $1 billion to these causes because he didn't really have anything else to say in his speech.
That's the value of being a speechwriter rather than a columnist. But yeah, and there's a great story of Warren Buffett has been going around saying, approaching billionaires and saying, if you give away half of your wealth, and then every once in a while somebody will say, well, I can't give away half of my wealth. I mean, that's too much. I have to think about my kids. And so Buffett's response was, you know, my next book is going to be on how to live on $500 million. So there's a real opportunity. We have a question about those those cases where it turns out the story just ain't so. The Greg Mortensen case, the case of Somali Mama, I don't know how the facts actually ultimately came down. But this was a question of sort of the personal story being
right.
somewhat off, not necessarily the cause.
The services, yeah.
Right. So
yeah, I mean, one of the problems is that backstories are a hugely powerful part of the fundraising effort. And one of the attractions of small organizations over, the large professional ones, one of the difficulties scaling is that people want to be a part of a very compelling individual story. Greg Mortensen, I think, quite clearly there was plenty of money that was misused and spent on books rather than on his schools. Somali, there are competing versions of what the truth is. I just don't know. Marie Claire and Newsweek have completely alternative versions of reality. At some level, it's a function of this, of the power of storytelling and And I guess what I would say is that, to some degree, there's always going to be in one's investment portfolio, there are going to be some stocks that you buy thinking they're going to soar and they just don't. And likewise, in one's charitable portfolio, there are going to be some that aren't going to have the impact that one hopes for whatever reason. I mean, in that case, it's less about impact and more about backstory, but still, I think the sort of larger truth holds.
Now, this questioner asks about diversity today in the United States, and in part because we've changed so much as a matter of demography, and some of our rhetoric about diversity is stuck in the 1960s when we had different demography. But another is in response to your article, Post Ferguson, and then I think
when
you got a lot of mail.
Yeah.
So say something about that. And how should we be thinking about race, and what is the role, again, of philanthropy, of individual citizens?
So after Ferguson, I wrote a piece that argued essentially that the racial problems we have in this country are less because of a fairly small number of out-and-out racists who, don't believe in racial equality. And rather, I think, a very large number of people who intellectually believe in equality, who think everybody, regardless of skin color, should have equal opportunity, and yet we suffer from implicit biases, that unconscious biases that we are completely unaware of. And, I mean, these actually also relate to gender. But we have abundant evidence that well-meaning people who believe in equality, when they look through resumes, that if there are two resumes and one is a traditionally black name, then we think that that person is probably not as good a hire as this exact same resume with a name that is more likely to kind of seem white. We're same with gender. We're more likely to think that Jim Johnson's resume is that he seems more impressive than the same resume when it's Jennifer. So then I got a lot of pushback, and so then I wrote a couple of columns about when whites just don't get it, which led to more of an inflamed reaction. At the end of the day, I think we have tremendous inequity of opportunity in this country. And part of it is a class gap, and part of it is a racial gap. And for many African Americans, their two are layered on top of each other. And if you are a low, if you are a low socioeconomic status African American kid, raised by a low income, stressed out, you know, teenage single mom, you know, you do not have real opportunities. You just don't. And there are lots of ways we need to address this. And part of this is government efforts. And it's a disgrace that this country is one of very, very few in the world that actually spends more educating advantage rich kids than it does educating disadvantaged poor kids. That's preposterous. But there are roles here for government, rectifying the criminal justice system, and there are roles for philanthropy. And I'd like to think that there's no such thing as a silver bullet. There's silver buckshot, you know, lots of little things one can do. And I do think that a lot of those silver buckshot are early in life and trying to get some of these kids a little more of an advantage early on so that they can begin school with a little more self-confidence, a little better reading ability, this kind of thing. And it's going to take a village to address them.
If you take on your comment about where we invest our money, most philanthropy goes from the wealthy to the wealthy.
Yes.
It goes to your kid's private school. It goes to the ballet class. It goes to the opera.
You know, absolutely.
It's the things you partake in.
And, you know, it's always seemed so frustrating to me that tycoons are always donating wings at business schools. And if they would only donate wings to nursery schools, you know, and that, yet it's been really hard to, you know, there should be naming opportunities at Head Start programs, at nursery schools, at early childhood programs, and we just tend not to think of it in the same way. But there should be ways of building community support for these early childhood initiatives, including nursery schools. And, you know, boy, they can use that money so much more than business schools that, you know, in some cases, are running out of ways to spend money.
At least in undergraduate universities, a university like Harvard, like your alma mater, is needs blind now.
Right.
So an investment in, you could argue, an investment in Harvard is an investment in diversity in higher education.
I
only just became the fundraiser for Harvard in the last 10 seconds. I didn't expect that.
I think about this a lot because I donate to Harvard, I donate to Oxford, and, you know, at the end of the day, the beneficiaries of those checks are going to be largely better off people. And I donate to arts organizations. And I wonder about this. I mean, you know, the things I believe in, you get a lot more bang for the buck in micronutrients abroad. And the way I sort it out in my own mind is that there are all kinds of ways we derive pleasure that aren't, in a sense, return maximizing. Cheryl and I go out to dinner. You know, that money would be infinitely better spent providing clean water to families in Niger. But it's really hard to live in a way where you are just trying to maximize social welfare in Niger. And so I think, indeed, that the highest returns are in some global anti-poverty interventions. And so Cheryl and I have, you know, a pool there. And then we also have a pool that we spend on us and then some other things kind of in between. I think of it like a buffet, and that as long as one doesn't take money from the Niger pool to donate to the Harvard or Oxford pool, then I think it's fine to show loyalty to an institution that took an Oregon farm boy, in my case, or to an arts organization that feels like it does something that means something to you. You know, but that it should be more out of the dinner with your wife pot of money rather than out of the Niger pot of money.
You've made reference to kind of feeling good or having a glow that comes. What is it about, I mean, in your book you point out that being wealthy doesn't actually make you happy necessarily, but giving does. So talk about the, sort of the physiological effect and emotional effect of giving.
There's always been a certain amount of population studies that go to this, that people who donate more are self-described happier, that they live longer, that they have better health. But there are always problems of disentangling causation and correlation from these studies. And there's some ways of getting around that suggest that it's real, but it's somewhat fuzzy. Although some of the numbers are striking, the one study of seniors found that joining a religious organization was associated with a 29% decline in mortality levels, exercising several times a week with a 30% decline in mortality, volunteering several times a week with a 44% drop in mortality. And I mean, clearly the solution there is that if you just volunteer for a religious running organization, you live forever, you know? But those population studies, more recently we actually have brain scans, and you can look at these pleasure centers in the brain like the nucleus accumbens that are associated with really primal pleasures. These are the things that light up when you eat fine food, when you have sex, when people flirt with you, when people compliment you. And so Cheryl and I we participated in a study where we are in an fMRI, our nucleus accumbens is being scanned, and we are watching a computer monitor, we have a clicker in each hand, we are given money, and nucleus accumbens glows, and we also are asked, you know, do you want to donate X amount to this or that? And indeed, that nucleus accumbens also glows when you make a donation. And for about half, and it turns out it varies a good deal with the individual. There's a tremendous amount of human variation, but for about half of research subjects, people seem to derive as much pleasure from giving, as much or more pleasure from giving, as they do from getting. So I really think there is a physiological basis for this. And there's huge debates among evolutionary biologists about why this is, but some suggestions about causal pathways.
Better than chocolate.
Yeah, chocolate is pretty hot too, though.
So we mentioned one example of peer-to-peer giving, and that was give directly, where an individual can ultimately give to an individual. There's another peer-to-peer model, and that's Kiva.
Yeah.
Where you can individually lend. Say something about Kiva and what kinds of results are you seeing there?
Part of the power of Kiva is that you feel connected to that person at the other end. It's a slightly, money is fungible, so it's slightly bogus, but it gives you that sense that you were helping this particular individual. And I think that's very, very powerful. I do think that one of the things we're learning, partly from randomized controlled trials, partly from Esther DeFlo's work, is that the most powerful aspect of microfinance is not micro-lending, but rather micro-savings. And micro-lending is very powerful for individuals who are naturally entrepreneurial and lack capital. But for individuals who aren't such brilliant entrepreneurs, the risk is they will get some money, start something, and actually end up more in debt. So on balance, the best, most careful, rigorous work on micro-lending seems to suggest that it helps modestly, it's useful, it's beneficial, but it isn't transformative. On the other hand, micro-savings seems to be very powerful, and basically, a third of the world's population is unbanked, doesn't have a way to save money. And typically you get your income a couple of times a year at the end of a harvest, so you have this huge pot of money, and what do you do with it? You can hide it under the bed in your unlocked hut. You can, in West Africa, you can deposit it with a money lender, and you pay 40% interest on your savings. Can you believe that? There have been these micro-savings schemes, and they're very cheap to start because the capital, of course, comes from the villagers themselves. It basically consists of a wooden box with several padlocks on it and different keys. The different villagers keep the different keys, and the box itself is in the home of somebody else. People bring tiny amounts of savings there, and then it's lent out to those natural entrepreneurs. And the result is that people have savings. So then when a woman needs a C-section and needs $30, she doesn't die because she has some savings. When a kid needs to pay $25 for school fees, the kid doesn't drop out because the family has some savings. And it's one of very few interventions I've seen that is actually self-replicated on its own, both in Southern Africa and in Nepal. These micro-savings schemes had such an impact on the villages where aid workers had introduced it that then when the aid workers left, then the neighboring villages saw that suddenly that village was doing much better. And they went to that village and say, so how do you do that? How do we get a lockbox? How does this work? And I mean, and I was looking at it in Malawi, and it spread actually across the border on its own into Mozambique. So I think it's I think that speaks to the incredible power of micro savings and kind of financial literacy more broadly.
And there's micro insurance now as well.
Yes.
So if your herd gets wiped out because of a blight, that's
then you're protected.
So I think this has been a very hopeful hour. So please join me in thanking Nicholas Christoph.